changed it. Changed it with my updates. Peter, did you know that although it's typically thought of as an agriculturally focused organization as a result of its history, today's 4-H focuses on citizenship, healthy living, science, engineering, technology programs.
That
Clubs
sounds
in
like
today's 4-H world consist of a wide range of options, allowing for personal growth and career success. It's officially a youth organization. It is a federal governmental program administered through the land grant university system
Oh, interesting.
in each state and territory. I think we both went to land grant
I
universities.
did, yeah. And what that
Headquartered in
basically means is
Washington, huh?
that part of the campus has to be like open land.
I don't know why.
I don't
I
know
just
why.
thought it was
That's what I took it
originally.
as. It's probably wrong.
I think it came from the Civil War in like the 1860s, and they like gave him a bunch of land
And just said, figure it
to
out.
teach agricultural, yeah, to teach agricultural schools. That's why I think in most university towns, like I know it's that way with K-State and University of Kansas, and it's definitely that way with Colorado State and Boulder. The land grant schools have the vet school and the ag farming programs, and then CU Boulder and KU have the
Law
law
degree.
school, and they're the hoity-toity rich people.
We
Is
have a, do you know we have
lucky.
a seed lab up
I don't even
here?
know what that means.
They have, I think they have a seed lab. Could be completely wrong, but I'm
Is that
fairly sure.
apple trees?
No, they just store a bunch of seeds in case of the apocalypse.
Oh,
Yeah.
CSU.
Yeah.
Well,
Little fun fact there
do you know
for
where it is?
you. No, it's
Just
guarded.
in
You
case.
just can't just walk up and be like, I
Well,
need pumpkin seeds for my garden. Can't do that.
I'm just saying things seem to be taking on a certain apocalyptic momentum, so it might be good to, when
Yeah.
that happens, bust into the seed lab.
I often think about that. When will we know when it's just really hit?
You
Because
know what?
if you don't study history, you might not know that, like, you read about some historical events, you're like, man, that must have been pretty awful. And then
And the
it's not
rug can get.
surprising, like, 2 generations later, people kind of just either don't remember or just kind of move on with it. It's kind of shocking in some ways.
See, I wonder, yeah, and I wonder how much. Sometimes it's a slow boil. I wonder if we're living through a slow boil
Slow
and it's just a
boil.
gradual thing. Like with the decline of Rome, it was kind of like that. Just gradually. But I don't know, there's other times. It was in a Guy Gabriel Kay book, actually, that I read. One of his ones that's like China, loosely based on China. Like that was loosely based on Renaissance Italy.
I just to the listener, I just held up the
Yeah. Anyway, it's off the point. You know how he does his thing. You can tell it's Italy, but it's different names. He did a two-book series about China like that. And one of the things I remember of those books, it was just Pika or one of those ancient Chinese civilizations, kind of the peak of the civilization. All the characters lived nice, cushy lives. And then there was a civil war. A general decided to revolt, and then it just like boom. And there's just an exile, millions of people like fleeing the city because there's an oncoming army. And it was just a really, I know it stuck with me. It's like a really well done, like you have periods of stability and then some changes and boom.
Yeah.
So you never know, one of the two.
Let's go back to 4-H.
Hold on, you know what? While we're here, I thought of something. How will you know when it happens? And then how do you know not to jump the gun? Like overreact to a news story and then pack everything up in your car and go to the mountains and then you realize like, oh, it wasn't that big a deal. Like nobody else is coming with you on the apocalypse. You jumped the gun and went out to the mountains a little too early and you gotta like sheepishly come back and pay your mortgage again. Like, oh, oops. I thought we were done. That we were done here. But
I
just
warned
some
you this might be a depressing episode, and I just had this depressing thought. What if, like, the apocalypse happens in small measures to different groups of people all the time,
Oh, that's what it is.
forever?
It's not
What's
one
this?
apocalypse. Yeah,
Yeah.
it's not one. The collapse of Rome was an apocalypse. That Chinese Civil War I talked about was an apocalypse when you live through it,
Yeah.
right? There's pockets of stability in the world, and there's like pockets of misery in the world. It's all happening all at once. So there's not just one Armageddon, not just one apocalypse.
So depressing.
I'm into it. It's not depressing to me. I'm kind of into it.
Yeah.
Anyway, hopefully my 4-H skills will help me living through our own little Western apocalypse.
You know, I didn't, you were in 4-H. I didn't know, to be honest, all I thought 4-H was walking a horse around and getting ribbons.
Sometimes you walk cows around.
Cows? Yeah, cows.
That's basically what it, you do a craft and get a ribbon if you're lucky.
Sounds fun. I didn't know it was tied to the government.
Oh, I didn't. I just read it off Wikipedia. I don't know if it is. I remember, you know, it's kind of weird. I remember I didn't really know what 4-H was until I was in it. My, you know, we just were brought to a little meeting, and they do like the Robert's Rules of Order. It's like there's one way you learn about civil procedure, whatever. There's the officers of 4-H who get elected, and they're all, you know, at a table, and they're got a gavel, and they're conducting the meeting according to Robert's Rules of Order and stuff. And I remember the president of 4-H, my first meeting, I'm in like fourth or fifth grade, I'm like young, and it's a high school kid. I didn't know it at the time. I thought it was like an adult. And I was surprised when they told me, no, he's in high school. I was like, he's in high school? Turns out he was a football player. He played in college. He played, and I remember I kind of followed his career because he was like the guy in 4-H. He tried out for the Miami Dolphins. He got invited to their training camp. He didn't make it. But now he owns a tire company in Kansas. And when I stream football games from Kansas and I see commercials with him, every Chiefs football game I watch, it's commercials from the I was like, I know that guy.
Can you say his name on the podcast, or is that free ads?
Oh, I don't mind free ads. I don't know what the rules are on that. Justin Glasgow. He played for KU. He was like, I thought he was like a grown man. I didn't realize it was just for kids because he was so big and opposed to the linemen.
Are there adults in 4-H?
No, adults kind of like run behind the scenes. They set it up. I think there's people who like monitor and make sure all the kids.
Do you make money?
I don't know. I didn't.
Can you?
You probably figure out some sort of racket. It's not. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if they do bake
sale. Is it like the Boy Scouts?
Vaguely, roughly, not quite. There's a pledge, but you don't get vests. I don't think we never had vests. I didn't stay with it through high school. It was just a grade school thing for me.
Okay. I don't think I have any more questions because I don't know if 4-H is all that.
Man, it's whatever. And there's a weird, I don't know if I sold the whole weird full circle thing. Like, yeah, that guy from TV. Hmm. And the fact that I stream the game, I live in a different state. Stream the game.
That's odd.
I see local Topeka commercials as I'm streaming. And I was like, I remember that guy.
Does he look any different? Does he look older?
He looks older now.
Well, obviously older, but older for his age? Because you thought he was like an adult when he was in high school.
Okay. He doesn't look that much older than us, frankly.
He's probably in his 40s now?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
So, you know, good for him.
And on that note, welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books and tire companies. I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt. Matt. Very topical, not really topical. It only has sort of a vague reference to the book that we're going to be discussing, reviewing. I think both praising highly, and that would be HHHH by Lauren Binet, I believe it was first published in France in 2009 or 2010, came to America in a translation in 2012. This book has been on my radar for quite a while, Matt. It got a lot, you know, praise. I think it won some awards over in France. It kind of seemed, for me at least, like the, not indie, but like, oh, this is like a, kind of like an underground, really interesting book, not your typical book. There's a lot of different ways we can kind of get into describing this book, I think. But it's always caught me as like a, you know, slightly unique type of book, off the radar, historical fiction. So I had high hopes going into this. Yeah. I'm curious, did you have high hopes going into this book? What were you expecting? Yeah. What did you know about the book? And we kind of got pushed over to like actually selecting it by a friend of the podcast. He's been on the podcast before, Sam Ernst. So that kind of helped us. But what were your thoughts going in and kind of your initial comments you want to say about the book?
I had high hopes because it was so highly recommended. because you recommended Civilizations by the same author, and Sam recommended this one so highly. And it sounded like a cool story, so I was like, okay, I like it. And you know what? I really like the book. It's a cool story. He does it well. I didn't mind. It's very metafictional. I wouldn't call it experimental at this point because that metafictional stuff has been played out, and it really is just a question of how well you pull it off. I would argue metafiction at this point is just another style. And if you want to break the fourth wall and converse with the audience, that's fine as long as you're interesting or entertaining. And he pulled it off. This is an interesting and entertaining story. And so that was his kind of. So I actually wasn't like, oh, it's structurally dazzling. I love the structure. I loved the guy's tone, and I liked the story he was telling, and I was just along for the ride. So it's good. I highly recommend it. I think to most people who are interested in this kind of stuff, it's great.
I'm glad you mentioned the word tone, because that was one word. It like from the very first page, he has a tone. It kind of to go over what the book is about and kind of how it's kind of unique in its own way and different. I don't want to say you've never read a book like this. I think there's kind of books like this that are published every year. Basically, this is the author is sort of a character in the book. Is that a way
Which is
you would describe
metafiction.
it?
That's not new. That's like
And he is,
not new at all.
and the story is these two Czechoslovakian kind of resistance fighters come back kind of early on in World War II, the resistance, kind of the person in charge of Nazi rule in Czechoslovakia is this guy named Reinhard Heydrich, kind of the Butcher of Prague. He is the title HHHH is in kind of refers to an SS saying, which basically translates to Himmler's brain is called Heydrich, right?
In German, that's all.
In German, yeah, I have it in my notes here. I could if attempt German, if you will. Himmler's Harnheist Heydrich. Himmler's brain is called Heydrich.
There's no connection to the American 4-H
Yeah,
as far as
not
I
there's
can
no
tell.
connection to the 4-H club
To
in
the
America.
Nazis, no. So
And
it's
it's
basically it's what these two guys are tasked with assassinating Heydrich,
yes.
basically. That's your.
And it's told, it's not like a linear plot line, right? But it kind of it's a story about backstory. It's interesting. It has a lot of history I did not know.
Me too.
Important history I like to point out too. And then it's this almost like what he as an author is like response like what he feels like he's responsible of like getting right and what he's like getting the story correct, and he refers to other like histories about this sort of subject and what he takes from it, what they get wrong. He seems to kind of like bash some books and kind of
He
like
kind
other
of did.
books,
He didn't like the kindly
the
ones either.
kindly ones. And interesting, there's like I think there's a story that a large chunk of his criticism of that book got taken out.
Yeah,
I think I read
absolutely.
that. So it's kind of that's where sort of the tone is, because he's sort of interjecting his time researching this book and then trying to come to like how does he want to tell this story? Does he want to, you know, what does he want to add? What are like kind of the themes here, or like what does he want the reader to take out of it? So it's you're learning that, but you're also getting the author, and it feels like as a debut novel, this is like a passion almost project for him. And that is revealed in the book where he cares deeply about this. And he has some very good quotes at the end that I'll get into that kind of like, I think reflect his, you know, how he feels about writing the book and how important he sees it. But as sort of like a historical fiction, it's the story of these two guys. They kind of all the trials and the dangers and their sort of moral quandary of once they know that if they succeed and they do succeed, kind of like in a roundabout way, sort of it does the plan doesn't go as kind of envisioned. You know, once if they kill Heydrich, then a lot of other people are going to die.
Because the Nazis are going to,
Nazis are going to retaliate, and the book goes into that.
right.
And they sort of know it's a death mission too. There's very unlikely that they're going to be able to escape. And the book has this like very tense, almost action scene at the very end of sort of their hold up in a church, and they You know, they try to hold, you know, they kind of keep at bay the Nazis for, I think it was like 8 hours or something like that. And they finally are killed. But it's that whole story. But it's a lot of, it's much more than that in a way, I think. And I thought, you know, it's one of my favorite books we've read for the podcast. And I thank Sam for encouraging us to read it. And I was kind of thinking, it has never struck me before, but we read historical fiction is kind of like a popular type of book that we read, right? And we've kind of read a lot recently. And I didn't realize how different the forms can be. Like, for instance, Burr, right? We read Burr. That's, I don't want to say that's like straightforward, but it's more, it's like a novel. I don't think it does anything. It's really good. It's a great book, but it's historical fiction. The Flashman novels, I would consider historical fiction, and they're completely different. They're more lighthearted, but also have a backbone of history. And then there's this book, which is, you can put some like fancy terms to it, but it is in essence a historical fiction book. And I just thought, I didn't really realize how you can kind of play with the form and play with the structure of historical fiction in a way that I think is very, I don't know, it leads to an interesting reading experience, is how I put it.
And I one of the things I appreciated about he kind of is he breaks the fourth wall, but he's talking about how he's going to handle the history because this is all true. And he talks about at the beginning how it is like a cool story his dad told him growing up, and he's enchanted with it. So he really wanted to do the story justice. And so in doing that, and one of the nice things about choosing to narrate it in this style is he can break in with he goes through all the old World War II action type books that dealt with Heydrich in the past, and he can kind of muse on those and incorporate it into his narrative. And it's very because if you're entertaining and interesting with it, you can get away with it. You know what I mean? Other Flashman and Burr and Dorothy Dunnett, they don't do that. It's a very different narrative. But if you're interesting about it, you can get away with it. So I liked him doing that. I liked him going because what action books or at the Alistair. What's his face? One of the just the World War II action book. You see, he's like, this doesn't pretend to be literature and it takes some liberties, but you don't care as much because it's not pretending to be accurate. And that's kind of where you can tell he struggles with. You know what I mean? And it's, I was thinking about The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet. That's pretty accurate. David, and I read some stuff about David Mitchell and how he approached it. It's very accurate. Do you know he actually wrote a version of that book that was in old-timey talk, like how they would have talked back then?
Really? Huh.
And he said it just sounded ridiculous to modern ear. Like it was accurate, but it just didn't work to a modern reader. So he had to scrap it and do it again. And the only real liberty he took is at the very end, there's an English or American ship that approaches Japan. And that was like 15 years off, but he wanted it dramatically. And he's put a little note. He's like, everything else, I went out of my way to make sure it's true, down to like the inflation rate of the Dutch currency or whatever. But the very end, he's got a little note saying, hey, this is the only liberty. So that's an interesting thing to muse on the if you're writing historical fiction, what obligation do you have towards historical accuracy? And he really dwells on that towards the end here. And I wanted to say, I actually like almost 100% disagree with him on some of the things he says about it, but it didn't take me out of the book. The book's like so good. I don't, it was like, oh, well, I disagree with that theory, but it
Interesting.
was a good book. And I love how he kind of just muses on this stuff.
In a way, I think part of the appeal of this book is I kind of think it's a really good book to like get people interested in history in a weird way, like historical fiction, just because it's not. For some reason, I think maybe historical fiction gets sort of like maybe a boring tag, or it's just, I don't know. I would say like high school readers, college readers, because it is like it's a very fun form that he takes, but it's a very somber. Like Heydrich is the kind of architect of the final solution with like the Nazis
He's
took. Like he's
that
a,
dude. He had it coming.
yeah, just a real truly terrible person. I didn't realize, and we'll talk about the movie that we watched. I didn't realize he was the highest ranking Nazi officer to get assassinated.
And he was in his number three. It was Hitler, what, Himmler, and Heydrich. So that's another thing that made the operations
And
of
he was
Bear.
kind of aiming to get, like, he was rising in the ranks. And
You can go
sort of how
down the
the Nazi
what-ifs.
Party works
Like,
is they're kind of fighting each other in a way.
he probably would have at least risen above Himmler, and then who knows if he would have been able to supplant him. It's there's all sorts of like historical what-ifs that Heydrich lived. But yeah, no, it's good. I love the backstory. You get Heydrich's backstory. He was kind of a screw up until the Nazis took power, and he was just kind of weaselly enough to, go through the ranks. And you get Gobcheck and what's the other guy's Kubik. You get their backstories, and it all kind of condenses on what you're saying about putting people off. I don't know if historical fiction puts people off. I would say don't let the fact that it's technically experimental metafiction put you off. Because a lot of times you're like, oh, it's fiction that's highly thought of in literary circles. People are like, oh, well, that's not going to be entertaining. For whatever reason, he pulled it off to where it's very entertaining.
It reminds me of one of those things where you like hear like that term, like, oh, that doesn't, but like once you get
That's
into it, once you actually read the book, you get that, like, that term just kind of gets cast aside, right? And you're just in the book and you're like, oh wow, this is,
And it's not, he wasn't academic about it. It's just like, oh, this is how he chose to tell the story with little asides, and you don't even notice him, breaking the narrative with a little,
You have, there are a couple of things that I just did not know. One was just like an awful thing. I did not know. Let me pull up my notes here. He talks about this kind of near in the middle of the book, Bobby Yar, which he kind of referenced is a natural ravine in Kiev, and the Nazis used it. It's just like this horrific scene to kind of highlight how bad they were, where it's just like this sort of natural ravine, and they, it's one of the, I don't know how he exactly phrases it, but like a couple hundred thousand people were placed in there and killed over like a couple year span. And like they have some documents that say like over a 2 day period in, I think, 1943, I want to say, like 32,000 people were killed. And they were like, well, the way he describes it, it's just such a just like horrific scene where it's like they just put these people in the ditch, they have them like lay down, they cram them in there, and then they just like shoot them, and you're like, holy, I never heard about that. So that stuck out to me. There's a lot of times where I was like, oh, I want to research this more while you're reading the book, or I want to read or like look up this book, because he references all these books as part of like his kind of experience researching this book. But I don't know, I think definitely if you're a historical fiction fan, you want to read this book, or if you just like good fiction and good writing, I think this book will
Appreciate
appeal
it.
to people. I don't think you really, if you're put off by sort of World War II history, I still think you give this book a try, because it is different, and it's a different tone and voice. And I think if you read a couple pages, you'll be like, if you like the tone and voice, you're gonna be like, this is going to be the book for you.
It's very entertaining.
I
It's
would
good.
almost say if you're in a reading slump too, pick up this book in a weird way, because just that, his passion and energy for telling the story, I think lends it to a highly readable book too.
Well, we're building towards something. It's an interesting backstory, but all the time we know we're building up to, do these guys get Heydrich? And then I didn't know the whole, I knew Heydrich was assassinated by parachutists, basically. And I actually can't believe I hadn't heard this story before, because it's a cool story. But like the whole, I like they hid out for what, 3 weeks, and could almost got away. Somebody betrayed him at the end, and there's a big shootout in a church. But had the guy not betrayed him, there's a chance
Well,
they could have
the guy
got
who
him.
betrayed him was like gonna betray him from like the beginning. Like it was almost,
And he did it for money. In the movie, they make it seem like he was just a nervous guy, but 4-H makes it seem like, oh no, he just took his opportunity to get money. Which.
And it's such, I thought about this a lot, like after I finished reading, kind of thinking about what we're going to talk about tonight, is that you want to as a resistance fighter, like, right, you want to get back at sort of the people who are like killing your countrymen, right?
Yeah.
And then there's like this moral quandary of like, once we do this,
if you know
the... how are we gonna wrestle with the fact that, and they talk about in the book this town called Lidice.
I
don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. It's basically wiped off the face of the earth, like
as a retaliation.
And
I
don't know. It's just a very, and he kind of grapples with it. It's like, how do you deal with that? Because your intentions are, oh, we gotta assassinate this guy, but then you're like, and this town, they has no real. They just picked it. They could not find it at the beginning. They could not find the.
And knowing that if you get caught, they're going to murder your entire family and anybody you've ever known. Right. Well, my wife and I were talking about that. We were watching the movie together, but how the resistance in World War II gets romanticized, and they should be valorized, very brave, but how scary it would have been. And it wasn't like you're shooting guns. A lot of people were just, you're on a list and you're a place to hide if people need it. And your life and your family's life is kind of just based on the people who know your name and you're part of the resistance, them not getting caught and getting your name tortured. Like the Gestapo would torture you, and then they give, you know, like how thin of a thread everything hangs on, how little of it's up to you. And a lot of times you're not doing the cool spy assassination stuff. You're literally just letting people into your house, or, you know, it's been so scary. It'd have been so scary. It's very, very brave.
And there's some, sometimes hear like, well, why didn't more people resist to fight? But it's like, on a whim, you could be, because some of the people that like help them, and this is kind of highlighted in the, it's talked about a little bit in the book and the movie. The movie we're referring to is Anthropoid, 2016. Pretty good movie that we'll kind of discuss a little bit more, but like just handing a note being like, I've watched his schedule. You would get killed. Your whole family, if they caught you doing that, you would.
And that's it. And that's, you know.
And just being in the room where they are, like, let's say my dad is hosting this group of resistance fighters and they're in the basement. I have no connection to them, but they're in the basement. Like, I will be killed.
If you had seen. Yes. Yeah. Well, and your dad doing that, he's got to know his kid could be killed. You know, you're just hosting. You're not doing anything other than just, you know, it was a very scary thing, very brave thing. You know, they have a term I read somewhere in French, naphthalenes, something like mothballs, or like a lot of people after the war was over broke out their old uniforms and talked about how they were in the resistance.
Oh.
But like, maybe not, you know, like it's hard to tell the people who actually did it.
And it's also the tricky thing is when you're thinking about the resistance, like, let's say you want to meet someone you haven't met before. How do you know?
And you know, they're not
like, you gotta drive yourself insane if you're like doing this.
Yeah. And that's why at a certain point, you just gotta like resign yourself to like, okay, whatever happens.
Yeah. You're just like, I don't know, I guess.
Like, but it's crazy. It was something about watching the movie this time around and after reading the book. Just like, man, I don't know. I don't know.
No, it's to do that, it's sort of the history. It's like incredible. Like, yeah, like you said, yeah, I don't know. It's a pretty incredible history. Any quotes, Matt? I'll do one of mine that I liked. And this is kind of going back to Benet kind of talking near the end about, I'm curious if this is one of the things you maybe disagree with. I don't know. He goes, the men and women and children who help them, talking about the resistance fighters, directly or indirectly, are not so well known. Worn out by muddled efforts to salute these people, I tremble with guilt at the thought all those hundreds, those thousands, whom I've allowed to die in anonymity. But I want to believe that people exist even if we don't speak of them. Which I thought, like, when you're talking about a historical novel, that's a very interesting thing to think about. Don't talk about, but like, they existed, but it's hard to capture everybody and how many people forgot. I don't know. It's just kind of a
No,
profound
that's good to
statement.
point. Well, how many other like plots like this that might have come off, but that got caught and
Yeah,
didn't make it, but
that's a good
everybody
point.
involved died and they were just as brave, but they didn't, you know, they're not remembered because they just the Gestapo rounded them up and shot them. No, that's a very good question. I don't disagree with that.
Give me
It's
some of the quotes
all
or
right.
kind of things that I'll see how I feel about them. Because
So this is just, I disagree with some of his philosophy on historical fiction, and I
okay,
kind of forgive it because, or forgive it, you know, like I don't mind. This is
yeah.
entertaining enough. And I get that it's so close. Like people are still living from this era, and he's from France. So, you know, like it's like, all right, I'll give you like caring about it extra much or extra, you know what I
I
mean?
got what you said.
You know what I mean? Extra hard, going the extra mile, extra much. So when he's talking about, he says, you know, a Milan Kundera quote about there's something can't corny, or the Kundera says there's something corny or something about giving an invented name to an invented character. And then this is Benet. In my opinion, Kundera should have gone further. What could be more vulgar than an invented character? And I'm like, no. I
I know what
don't
you're talking about because there are parts in this
know.
book where he's like, they got the color of the car wrong or something.
I was gonna bring that up later,
But I was like, oh, that's kind of, I don't know, pedantic
It's a
or
bit
whatever.
much and pedantic, yeah.
But then also, if you can get it right, why don't you just get it right?
It depends on what you're trying to
I
do,
know, I know.
right? And then is, and this is like pertaining to him for the way he's going about this story. Great.
I mean, I think you would almost admit that like it's a very personal thing, and this is not maybe a universal like
And maybe that's what he's phrasing it as a universal advice. And I
maybe, yeah.
think it's more acceptable to me. It's like, okay, no, he's just talking about his, he means his process for this book because he didn't want to invent a character. And he says here what inventing a character to help establish historical facts is fabricating evidence. Which, once again, no. Like Charlie Schuyler from Burr, he served a purpose and it carried that book and it actually brings Burr to life. But
I wonder,
I think.
I kind of agree with what you're saying as far as historical, like, but I wonder if he's coming from a place where, considering the subject matter and that he feels if any sort of fabrication gets brought into the story of, you know, sort of the World War II Nazis, all this stuff, it provides a crack in sort of, I don't know, that seems like a very like, slim theory that that's possible. I don't know. Like, you know what I mean? Like, if you introduce fabrication into this story, then he might worry, well, you can then fabricate, you know, X, Y, and Z, and then you start getting into sort of like the gross waters of like Holocaust denial and stuff like that. Like
Or water, yeah. Well, it could
that's
go
a
to any different.
I that's a I don't know if I even believe it, but I can that argument could be made. You don't want to make. But
The
then, I
worst
mean, that's
case
you're taking it
situation.
pretty literal and serious. Like, I
Well,
think there's some understanding that historical fiction, you don't want to just like completely make up stuff. But if you want to combine characters together to, then they kind of, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I think maybe that's the crux of it here. Him doing that for this story is fine, but he kind of phrases it like universal laws for historical fiction.
Yeah.
And the part of my brain was just like, well, hold on a sec. You can't do that. It works for him here.
Yeah.
But what you're talking about with the car, the different color of the car, that was from the, he really took the kindly ones to task. But, and the one part is the guy, Jonathan Littell, the author of the kindly ones, talks about Heydrich pulling up in a black whatever model of car that drove. And then he really is like, how do you, it wasn't that he got the car wrong. He took issue with Littell assuming it was black and not dark green or whatever. He's like, you don't know for sure it's black. So it's that level of detail. And I kind of marked that. I was like, ah, you know, you can't it because it's a most he went through it. He's like, most of the Gestapo cars of that era were black, but not all. So how could Littell really? It's like, well, I
Yeah.
think you need to just let him. He has a different set of rules than you.
I do the kindly ones was created a stir, I think it was like 2005, maybe when it came out. I
I
don't think
vaguely,
we're
I haven't even read it. I just.
No, but I remember it being a very controversial book. And I don't know enough about it to talk about like sort of what Binet would told. It sounds like he really had a problem with it. Only like a few things. Like one thing, he liked the description of Heydrich at some point, but that almost seemed like a passing praise type thing. But I did like sort of, there were some books I was like, oh, I never heard of that book before, kind of underlined. So yeah.
Well, and I like Author Feud. I think people need to get into it more. I was just saying, like, leave ease up on the car, because that only really works for this story again. As a general rule for historical fiction, you can't get on people if you're reading a book about the Crusades,
Yeah.
right? And they describe King Richard riding up on his chestnut brown horse. You just gotta, he had a chestnut brown horse. You can't be like, how dare you say it's chestnut brown? It could have been black, could have been spotted, could have been white with a red mane. It's like, you can't do that. That's not a general rule for all historical fiction. It really just can't be. Otherwise, you wouldn't get anywhere. You know? So those are my only, I guess, quibbles. But like I say, it doesn't take me out of the book.
I think in some way this is a battle for him too, Binet, because he knows this, like he at the end he's like, he knows the story's not done for him. Like he tried to find out as much as he possibly could and grappled with it. He did this really, I thought it was really cool, like writer technique. It's like the book is made up of very short chapters. Like sometimes they're like a sentence long. And then when you get to the actual like assassination, sort of that, it's like a much longer, drawn out sort of prose and stuff like that. I thought that was very interesting. It was like short, choppy, one or two pages, maybe a little bit longer. And then there's like this, I want to say part two, it's like almost 10 pages. And it's like a thrilling scene almost. So it kind of highlights his ability to kind of change up a little bit of like form it. And having read his other book, Civilizations, like he's a very, very talented writer. Like he's clearly, I mean, this being his first book, high degree of difficulty, and like could have easily in lesser hands, probably not have been published at all. Like they would have been like, no,
Sure.
we're good.
This is a mess. This is, you know, and you know what I'm noticing? The more we do this podcast and delve into all these books, it's not the genre or the style or the whatever that makes the book. It really is. It really boils down to, boy, that this guy or girl's a really talented writer. That's kind of what it is. More for me than any sort of genre or style or mode or critique of fiction or whatever you want to call it. It really comes down to, is this person a good enough writer or storyteller to pull this thing off?
Also think it's those off, and then there's like how much effort are you putting into your work, right? How much are you going to tinker with the book? How much are you going to put a lot of your thought? Because I feel like we've read enough books. You can kind of tell when a person is just sort of, yeah, these ideas are kind of not fully formed, right? And you kind of see through, kind of some lazy writing. But if you, I think, being a lazy writer is probably one of the worst things you can fall into a trap of, right? Because then, I mean, to me, this is the opposite of lazy writing. This is, I don't know. I bought fantastic book. Anything else? Do you want to move over to the movie now, or do you have any?
Let's see. Oh,
I
not
would, I would,
much.
I want to say this, and I was curious to get your opinion. Do you think this book should be like, if this was taught in schools, do you think that would be a crazy idea? Do you think that would be, it'd probably get like,
I think they'd have trouble with it.
yeah.
I think
What about
if maybe
college?
a cool teacher could maybe sneak this onto the syllabus and use it as kind of an example of, but just kind of the short chapters. The fact that it's like an act half action spy story, it doesn't seem like serious academic fiction, but it's also metafiction, so it breaks
Yeah.
the wall. But it's not academic metafiction because it doesn't have its head up its own, let's say, navel, and it's not, you know what I mean? It's not
Yeah.
boring, Right. And I think a lot of academic metafiction kind of missed the point that, like, you can do whatever you want experimentally and experiment with structure, but if you're not entertaining or interesting, it's not a good, why write the book? Right? If you're not going for something.
If
Right.
you
So I think
just
that kind of gets, so teaching it in schools, it depends on what the school's trying to teach. It would kind of, I don't know, I think maybe the rebel professor who wears a leather jacket, tennis shoes. You know what I mean? But like that sort of thing, maybe he would teach it as a way to kind of thumb his nose at the
I
academic.
just for me, it's like a book for the right reader. I feel like it could just be like a spark. And it almost like kickstart like a, oh, I want to read more, which is kind of the point, really. Like at that point in your life, you just if you would kick someone to read more and you could go off and read all these because there's I would say like a dozen references to books, movies, that kind of stuff in
Let me
this.
ask you this. Precocious 14, 15-year-old.
I would say you'd want to be a little bit older, a little bit
Some
more
heavier
back.
stuff in it.
Yeah, or
But
like a
I
little
think,
bit backed, but
somebody who like he likes to read, but he's bored by the stuff they give him in schools. I might be like, you know what? There's some curse words in it, not too much, but why don't you try this? I think I
nothing.
might do that.
Yeah,
Try
but there's nothing that's like
teenager.
a
Maybe 16,
teenager's.
whatever, you
I don't
know?
know. Yeah, all that stuff. I feel like a
It's
teenager.
heavy, but they make you read Anne Frank in high school,
Yeah,
you know? So it's
and it's
not
like.
like, yeah.
I think part, one of the things Benet talks about is like it's really important to like remember the story. To like
I happen, but true.
novels need about this need to like continually to be written for new audiences, right?
Well, yeah, people do this to each other. It's
Yeah,
not
yeah.
within living memory.
Had you ever heard of Bobby Yar? I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
No, but I knew stuff like that happened.
It's
When
just,
actually, what you were, they shot them all.
yeah.
That's one of the things. Heydrich, I'd read somewhere else that the Nazis came up with the gas chambers because it's not an efficient way. That's like a lot of bullets, just if you're just like boil it down to efficiency. And also, some of the guards who had to shoot all those
I was going to
people,
say
it
the
was
guards were like having.
psychologically getting to them, so they tried to figure out a more efficient way to kill all these people. And so that's, and I guess Heydrich was one of the people who like figured out the logistics of the concentration camps and the gas chambers, which is another reason, like, this guy, like, he really had it coming. You're really rooting for
Yeah.
his assassins here.
There's.
And but it's just, and he was like the main guy and one of the like the rabbit holes. Like, I think people have theorized like Heydrich might have wound up supplanting Hitler. And I don't know if he would have won the war, but he might have sued for peace. Like, the world would have been in much worse shape, maybe, had he lived. If you, I mean, whatever. You don't, you never
Yeah,
know these things.
apparently there's
But
another when they had and they basically gave Czechoslovakia over to Germany in like what was it, 1938.
the Munich,
There
yeah.
was some passage I can't remember where it was where they were basically after the war they were like, if Great Britain had been like no, like what would Germany have done? And I think some German officers like, oh, we weren't prepared to like fight a war at that point. Which they would be like, I guess, a year later, and who knows if that's actually true. But
Yeah,
there's some
well,
like there's some hypotheticals in the book that are kind of interesting to think about
interesting.
too.
Side note, you know, Christopher Hitchens has an interesting essay about that
Chamberlain and
Chamberlain and the peace and the Munich
the Munich
Act, what I
Agreement,
call
yeah.
it, peace in our time. He's not defending Chamberlain. But what he says is a lot of times people hold up the example of Chamberlain. Oh, he's holding that paper, Peace in Our Time, as naive, and Chamberlain as like a hippie type anti-war person. And Hitchens' point was he wasn't anti-war. He was cold-bloodedly, he's calculatingly trying to like save the British Empire from like the Nazis taking over any British territories in Singapore, India, and wherever else. And he had underestimated Hitler's bloodlust, or whatever you want to call it. So it was almost, Hitchens points out, it was almost worse because he sacrificed Czechoslovakia, hoping that would appease Hitler and Hitler would stay away from British overseas possessions. If that makes sense. It was
Yeah.
just, here's the different take on Chamberlain. Don't give him a pass as a naive peacenik. He actually sacrificed the
Yeah.
Czechoslovak to try to get Hitler to stay away from British Empire. And it obviously didn't work and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it just came to mind.
Yeah.
They kind of screwed the Czech people over.
Oh, yeah. It's.
And I should say, I also, even though Benet had a note about it beginning, I don't necessarily understand the difference between Slovaks and Czechs, and apologize to everybody there.
I've been meaning to like kind of understand European, kind of like the geopolitical,
the Balkans especially,
just the big long history. And if we ever read a what's it,
Black Lamb, Gray Falcon.
Goes into that. I think it's the best book for us to like fully understand. Do you want to add it? Maybe. I don't have any. It's a great book.
It's a really good book.
People should read it.
You want to get to the movie? I have a whole.
Yeah, let's get to the movie.
Okay. Well, I have another 10-minute like wormhole about the Holocaust being the flip side of the Enlightenment.
Oh, geez.
Well, we don't go into that.
I don't know if I'm ready for that.
It really ticks Steven Pinker off.
Okay.
I'll rein it in. Let's not go there. Movie.
Anthropoid. I'm an idiot. I didn't realize. I thought for a second I was like, anthropod and opoid.
Sounds sci-fi. Supposedly, Benet's original title was the French wording for Operation Anthropoid.
Yeah.
Which just thought it sounds like sci-fi. And it kind of does.
Kind of does.
It was the legit
point is human-like, or yeah.
Yeah, but that's the name of the operation. So
stars Cillian Murphy, who I believe is an Irish actor, and Jamie Doran.
Yeah.
50.
He's really good in it.
Very good movie.
I had to look up who he was. Like, who's that guy? He's the 50 Shades of Grey guy.
Yeah,
But it works in, because Benet talks about how Kubik, his character was like movie star handsome.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of makes sense. Okay, that guy's like striking looking, but so was the real guy. So they got, it was well cast, well acted. I really liked it.
Yeah, it didn't get great reviews when it came out. But again, I can't trust Rotten Tomatoes, I guess, sometimes, but it got like some 64% or something like that. I thought it was just a very good, kind of a pretty emotionally impactful movie, really focusing on sort of our two, like, parachuting in. You don't get, there's another movie that kind of focuses on Heydrich that came out like a year later, which is more closely related to the book. I don't know. It has a completely different title than HHHH. But if you want a pretty good movie about just who these guys were, and it's almost a movie in two parts, kind of the lead up to the assassination and then sort of the second half, which I always feel like more gripping and more tense is sort of, can they escape? And then
you're rooting for them too. It's like, but ah.
Yeah, like the line of better term, like the shootout at the church.
Yeah. We got to think. So after one of the cool, like, true historical things is the guy, they had Heydrich's route down. They had to do it. That Heydrich is about to get transferred to Paris. They only had one more day to pull off the plot. A lot of this is plotted like a World War II movie, but it's like actually true.
Was he going to take over in Paris as sort of like get a handle on the French resistance?
Yeah, I think so.
Remember that? Okay.
And that's another reason, like, it's probably good. I mean,
yeah.
But anyway, so one more day to complete the operation. They have his route down. You know, they have the four guys set up. One guy, they didn't know. Sometimes he traveled with soldiers as an armed escort. Sometimes he didn't. So they didn't know whether he was going to or not. So they had a guy with a grenade ready to go to throw at the soldiers, and a guy with a machine gun to jump out in front of Heydrich and shoot him.
A British Stein.
Time it perfectly.
Yeah.
Guy jumps out in front of Heydrich with a machine gun, point blank, good to go, and the gun jams. Like in a movie, in a movie, something always has to go wrong. The gun jams, but the other guy throws the grenade. They get Heydrich, but Heydrich lives, and there's a big shootout. And the Nazis, so the parachuters think they failed. Prague is just on lockdown; no one in or out. They just have to hide.
Yeah,
and it just passes over. It's like, can you? And so anyway, it's a And they just it's a gripping movie. It's a good movie. I would recommend, if you are going to read the book first and the movie. I think maybe that might be part of it. Once you know what's going to happen and who the characters are, it is kind of fun to be like, okay, I know who that is,
I
how
agree because
oh.
somehow this is not until like recently with this book and like the couple movies that I don't think I had heard of this as
I was
like
a
a
big World
story.
War II history guy growing up, and I don't really, I never
And
knew
this
the
is a,
details.
like a thrilling story of in the war. So I'm kind of surprised there. And I think the movie is 2 hours of it. Very good, kind of a very impactful last scene. What's that? Oh, what's that? The he was Capote in one of the
Toby Jones.
Toby
He's the
Jones.
bowler.
I was not expecting him. I like him. He's a good actor.
He's a really good actor,
And Cillian Murphy's very good. The love interest, I was that referenced in the book at
Yeah,
all? Okay.
actually it was.
That was a fit. And then you feel terrible for there's actually a brutal scene where
Yeah, that's the
son,
worst. Like
yeah,
that's
that's, I
yeah.
was like I'm not expecting that. So yeah, it's definitely
There was a
R-rated.
one torture scene, but well.
Yeah, and kind of how what we're referring to, like any sort of connection to those guys were killed. And then also a whole town that had no connection, and they kind of referenced that in the movie where they're like, I've never been to the Deedsie. I didn't realize, and the book talks about this, that town became a rallying cry for like the Allies and all these different countries to be like, never forget. And sadly, like, it's sort of been forgotten in a weird, like,
Well,
maybe
and then
that in
but a lot of other
America.
stuff
I
happened
don't,
in
I would assume
between.
it's more known in Europe and stuff like that, but it's definitely not a story that gets taught in American school, so it's another reason to read the book. Yeah, I give it 3.5 stars, Matt.
Out of
Five.
the book?
The movie.
Oh, okay.
I
That's
was
simple.
thinking I might have given it 4. The book I gave 5 stars.
Yeah, fine. I give the movie 4. The movie's a good movie. I'm
Very,
glad I
yeah.
watched it. Well acted. I'd say read it, watch it after the book, though. You'll
Do you have
understand
any
all
interest
that's
in
going
reading
on.
in the, I want to say it's The Man with the Iron Heart, although
Of watching it? The movie?
that sounds like, I don't know if that's the correct term.
No, and I saw some of the other. I looked up the other movies you talked about at the beginning. Conspiracy with Kenneth Branagh. I found that.
I saw that.
Oh,
That
did
is an
you?
excellent movie. It's about like the, I don't know what you would call it. A meeting, a retreat of all the Nazi officials to come up with, it's
When
really
they do
depressing
the.
and just like, oh, it's just that retreat. And what's that? Is Stanley Tucci in that? Let me look that up. I think Stanley Tucci's in that. That's an excellent movie.
So that, I'd heard of the Robert Harris book he talks about, the kind of alternate history where the Nazis win and the Holocaust is kind of like forgotten history. And a journalist like investigative journalist brings it up,
Gotcha. Huh. Yeah, I didn't realize Kenneth Branagh played Heydrich.
Then
I thought.
Benet say the one thing he didn't quite capture, like Heydrich had a high pitched, kind of
He
funny
does.
voice,
He also, I
more
looked at.
funny sounding.
He doesn't really look like Heydrich at all.
Wow.
Heydrich in the movie we watch is only in the one scene really, and he looks very
He
close.
looks more like,
Yeah.
but supposedly Heydrich had a goofy voice that didn't mesh with this kind of like chiseled Nordic looks. Like a
Interesting.
funny high-pitched voice,
Interesting.
but
Interesting. Any other thoughts, Matt, on book, the movie? What would you, we've done this before. What would you kind of, is this, what would you say this book is like? I don't know.
oh,
I'm
I'm
trying to
glad
think
you
of
brought
that.
that up. That's my last. It actually reminds me of The
Your
Princess
favorite.
Bride.
Right.
The Princess Bride format in a weird way.
Okay.
And that Nick Tosh's book, King of the Jews, that I talked about a while ago,
Okay.
they're both kind of meta, but very entertaining. You'd be surprised. Like, I guess you haven't seen the movie Princess Bride either, but the book The Princess Bride is kind of a meditation on, like, oh, marriage and love. And the movie's, a romantic, like, true love, whatever. It's a good movie. But then the book kind of goes into, would these two people actually live the fairy tale life? And William Goldman is writing the book as William Goldman, who's married to his second wife and has a kid, and he's in Hollywood writing a screenplay, and it's just all this stuff, and there's like layers, and he's writing in a very conversational style, and then he gets back to the exciting story that he's telling with interruption. It's good, and it really is kind of structured like The Princess Bride.
There's got to be a different word than metafictional, I feel like.
Well, that's kind of what it, I think.
I know, but it just, I feel like it's off-putting to people. It seems like homework, but it's
I
not.
know, right?
It's
And then people talk about metafiction like it's new, but like The Princess Bride is a very entertaining book, and it's self-referential metafiction. And then the Nick Tosh's book, I read it when we read Eight Men Out, and you could kind of tell Tosh's was like gonna write a more traditional biography of Arnold Rothstein. And more he dug, the more he figured out this guy is actually not a romantic figure. He's more of a gangster heroin dealer who sometimes gambled. And so he kind of just like flat out says, like, at this, like, there are several narrative arcs I could take here that would make this more entertaining, but I really don't want to glorify this guy. So, and you kind of got all his research leading up to it, and a history of gambling, and history of German Jewish people in the 1600s in Poland. And it kind of Tosh's was a good enough writer where you're kind of along with them for the journey, even though it's structured kind of all over the place. But those are the two books it reminded me of stylistically.
I like it. I just saw in the notes to this book, this is the translator Sam Taylor. This is his first translation.
Sam Taylor.
There you go. From French.
Good translation too, because you never know, like
I'll be completely honest. I don't know if I could tell a good translation from a bad translation.
Well, I think you know a good one when you read it, because when you don't even notice.
If you do a good
You know what I
translation of a
mean?
bad book, does that make you a bad translator or a good translator?
No. No, I think it makes you good. I think it's but really good authors you love in translation. I think you kind of trust the translator must be very
That's
good.
true.
Because,
That's true.
well,
That's
and
very true.
especially with Murakami.
Okay. Yeah.
I think his translators deserve a lot of credit because they can kind of transfer over the meaning of the word and not just do a literal word for word, or the meaning of the story, the meaning of the
Yeah.
phrase. I think it's a very difficult thing. I think
Okay.
translators deserve more credit than
I
they get.
think, yeah, I agree with you. Do you want to do a kick this 2024? We just read World War II historical fiction, depressing books, Matt. I got some. Are you want to take a break?
Well, not depressing. I'm down for some World War II stuff. I'm down for more historical fiction. I didn't find this too. I mean, there's grim stuff in there.
Yeah.
This wasn't a depressing book. This is
That's, yeah.
good. Just is good book.
Upcoming books. I don't know what order we'll do this in, but some upcoming books that we'll do reviews and discuss in the next weeks and months is a book I think we both is kind of I think we'll have a very good discussion, and that's book one to A Dance to the Music of Time, A Question of Upbringing is that book. We also have The Historian and Black Spider. That's kind of from our spooky October. A few months ago, we have The Poison King, which I'm eager to get into. We have the Fellowship of the Ring. And if you didn't hear our last episode, we added two novellas and six essays slash short stories, which include Notes from the Underground and Breakfast at Tiffany's, as well as pieces from Hunter S. Thompson, Paul Bowles, Neil Gaiman, Joan Didion, Franz Kafka, and Christopher Hitchens. And we're hopeful that we've set a goal for ourselves. One of our, this must be over a year old, The Master and Margarita, which we hope to do the beginning of March at some point. So that is our TBR. Thoughts on that
Maybe
TBR?
spring.
Maybe
I'd
spring.
originally said the end of February, but I'm afraid that's not happening. But springish.
Oh, it's very Russian. Fun.
I don't know what the deal is with that cat. Is the cat Stalin?
That's a good question.
Or is the devil Stalin and the cat's Jesus? I don't know. Or the cat's the devil? Let's find out.
We also are going to be picking over on our Patreon. If you like this, you can join us over on our Patreon for a few bucks a month and get some more additional content. We'll be picking our newest thriller here in the next week or so to continue our thriller corner, as we call it over there on our Patreon. I put out my library report. I read a couple books in January. I'm reading a book right now, Matt, from the library. Just came out. It's a book called My Friends, mm-hmm. about a Libyan kind of asylum seeker. Yeah. And it is in London. It is fantastic. Okay. It might be one of the better modern literary fiction books I've read in a long time. I'm not done yet. I'm almost probably 3/4 of the way through. Fantastic. Okay. My Friends.
Okay. I want to hear more about these. The lead up to the French Revolution thing, we could do a little segment on that. I want to
discuss. Yeah, I'm reading. That's a very. I went into that book knowing really nothing. I'll say that. A little. And it's really fat. It's a lot about like what the people, how the people got their news, how they were feeling. It's sort of like the 40 years up to the French Revolution. And yeah. Like what issues were, the king was kind of losing grip on stuff. And it's a really fascinating book. If you're just like a general history person, you don't know anything, you'll get a lot from this book.
Let's loop it back around to talk of Armageddon at the beginning. It was like a slow burn until stuff finally happened in 1789. But you're getting the context of here's the 40 years building up.
True.
Patterns of famine and out of touch aristocracy. See, we could talk about this for a bit. I just read an interesting one of my little side projects is about the decline of empires and stuff. And the guy was talking about how that sort of revolutionary period in Europe. There's a reason in the French and American Revolution, a lot of the revolutionaries were lawyers. Mm. Aristocracy, they were rich and entitled and had all this land, money. But there was at that time where real wealth was moving from the feudal system of just having a bunch of land, which is easy enough to oversee, to kind of the complex financial interactions.
Yeah.
A little harder to oversee than like an estate with a farm. And manage your crops. And so they had to hire people to like run things for them, a lot of lawyers and people who can do the paperwork. And at a certain point, you know, spoiled rich kids are distant anyway. The lawyers kind of figured out we could run this on our own. We don't need the kings. And there's a reason as both, and they kind of like, they fomented this revolution, but it's also like, we can run this and we can be the new aristocracy because they really don't know what they're doing. So let's just take the reins ourselves.
Now, you would like this book. It's called The Revolutionary Temper by Robert.
I saw your post on it. I was like, we should get it.
Yeah. 1748 to 1789. We just got some chapters on Voltaire, Rousseau. There's some religious kind of feuds going on. It's complex, but it's done in a very, you can understand it. You might not remember all the French names or whatever.
Probably don't pronounce them right in your head.
Definitely don't do that. And My Friends is Hisham Mattar. I've never heard of that author. It was getting some great reviews. Those are kind of the two books that will be on my February that I'll discuss over on our Patreon and maybe on an episode with Matt here. So. And I started reading Ironweed. I told Matt off air last week. He was kind of avoiding the really sad stories or books where kind of as a new father, he doesn't want to read about children.
Yeah.
I told him. He made a very smart decision because it's a super bummer of a book.
I'll listen to you recap it and talk about it, but I don't think I'll actually read it.
You have to be about 10 pages in before I could have been like, yeah, you should not read this book, Matt. It is, it's a fantastic book Ironweed by William Kennedy, but one of the sadder books so far I've read. I'll say that. Thanks as always for listening, and be on the lookout for upcoming episodes. And as always, we will talk to you soon.
Bye.